You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Well, let's save this. Let's save this. I want to get into this. Hold on. I'm too excited.
Okay, all right. Let's start.
I'm told we're already rolling. All right, well, this is The Brian Callen / Hunter Mott Show, and our guest is Professor Darren Acemoglu. Or Acemoglu. Let's just say Moglu.
Acemoglu, yes.
Yes, and
that's
And he wrote, along with James A. Robinson, wrote an amazing book here called Why Nations Fail, The Origins of Power, Prosperity, and Poverty. And for me, it was a personal book. First of all, it's a heretical book around here because we've had Jared Diamond on this podcast, sir, and we're always talking about guns, germs, and steel, and in many ways, this book is a rebuttal, not only to that, but It really was much appreciated, the effort that went into this. In a culture where we really, you know, esteem and celebrate entertainers, it kills me that we don't celebrate people like yourself who put in such a major effort and you know, decide to say there's so many theories on why nations fail. There's so many theories on why, you know, some nations are wealthy and others are not. And some of it is cultural and geographic and religious. And of course, you rebut all of that stuff. For me personally, growing up in the developing world, I lived in India and Pakistan and Saudi Arabia and Greece and Lebanon. And I was always this sort of white kid surrounded by people who were usually brown, who didn't have as much as I did. And I knew even as a kid that somehow the math had fallen in my favor. Somehow I was just born lucky. And I remember vivid images. I remember walking through the souks of Yemen and seeing people with leprosy and all those things and wondering, why me? I come from this country called the United States. I had a vague idea that maybe it was free enterprise. Maybe it was something like capitalism or democracy or the Constitution. But I didn't know how it came to be. And in many ways, you answer those questions in this book, Why Nations Fail. So that's a long introduction, and Hunter's sitting there. He always twirls his finger like, Brian, you're talking too long. But I'm very excited to have you on the podcast because
well, it's great to be here, and that was a great introduction. I love it. You can go on if you want. If you're gonna say nice things, I won't stop you. But I wanna just say that, you know, it is very much related to Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel, and in some sense, it does go in a different direction, and you can even call it a rebuttal. But I also want to add that, you know, Jared Diamond is an inspiration to us all. I mean, I think that's a fantastic book. It's tightly argued. It's exciting. It's original. It's full of ideas. You know, if even if we disagree on some parts of it, it's we would all be lucky to have Jared as an intellectual inspiration.
It's an important Guns, Germs, and Steel is still an important seminal book in many ways.
Then. Well, and I think the point is that both of them reveal that, you know, rather than because we look at the prosperity of white people, the prosperity of Europeans, and we look at the poverty of so many other people, and both your book and Diamond's book really just say, hey, it's not that these people are inherently better. It's that there were circumstances operating, whether they be institutional factors that you talk about or whether it be access to species that can be easily just domesticated, which is what Diamond talks about.
Right.
Well,
exactly.
But we should talk, but mainly that you make the argument over and over again, and you use the word extractionist policies over and over again in the book, meaning that really you say that yes, disease, yes, geography, yes, culture, yes, religion may have play a factor to a degree, but really not what creates lasting wealth overwhelmingly. Is representative institutions that represent their population, and more importantly, institutions that allow and nurture a population's innovation and freedom and right to their own property.
Yeah, it is. I mean, in some sense, exactly like you said, it's not, you know, nobody would deny that whether you have huge oil wells, you know, like oil reserves like Qatar does, is irrelevant. But, you know, what we're saying is that those things, natural resources, your other geographic characteristics, what disease environments you have, whether you have navigable rivers, what sort of domesticable animals and plants you had, you know, 10,000 years ago, those are all going to be secondary because at the end of the day, you can see all around you all these countries that take more or less the same natural resources, more or less the same environments, but they come up with very, very different outcomes in terms of the prosperity of their peoples because they are able to build different institutions. Look at Norway, which has had a very, very different track record of dealing with a huge oil windfall versus Nigeria or Venezuela when they realized, you know, they had huge amount of oil. In the first case, you know, that has not had any impact on their already democratic, support, strong, inclusive political institutions, and those political institutions managed to find a way of using that oil wealth in a stable, sustainable manner for the good of the people. In the second case, there were...
You're talking about Norway. Norway in the first case.
In the first case. Yeah. And then in the second case, Nigeria or Venezuela, you had these huge civil wars because under the weak institutions, it was very clear from the get-go to everybody that whoever was sitting atop of the political institutions was going to be able to benefit at the expense of the rest of society from the oil well. So everybody started fighting. So that's sort of the image that I think is very useful for thinking about. It's not that, you know, natural resources or geography are totally irrelevant, but their impact is very much mediated by the institutions.
And I mean, that's how you really open the book. You compare North Korea and South Korea, people who have a shared history, shared culture, shared language, shared gene pool,
shared geography,
and yet such different outcomes.
Absolutely. That's too sharp an illustration of it in some sense. I mean, you know, it's incredible. It's like you have these two parts of exactly the same country and a very, very homogeneous country at that. And then within about 60 years, you have more than a tenfold gap between the two. I mean, that's just mind-boggling.
It is.
But once you start thinking about, look at the incentives created in North Korea, look at the all of that repression of the people's talent in North Korea versus the over time increasing freedoms, economic and political, in South Korea, I don't think it's surprising.
The at the root, though, of so much of this, it was just mind-boggling. Like reading your you know, essay on the chapter on the African slave trade. You were talking about Muslim and Christian countries for the most part. I mean, and the tenets of Islam and the tenets of Christianity would suggest, you know, I mean, if you read the Bible, you read the Quran, you know, you're not supposed to enslave people. The fact that human beings throughout most of our history have had such utter disregard for anybody who didn't come from where they came from or didn't speak their language, the brutality of the genocide that the Dutch committed and other people in the name of, you know, the spice trade and things, that's what's amazing to me. We seem to have evolved at least now into the idea that people are more and more, I think most people on the globe would say that we're all way more connected than we're different. But back in those days, I just can't imagine taking, you know, coming into a city or a town and a village, killing everybody and just taking the people you want as slaves. It feels like so much of what destroyed any kind of progress in any of these societies, whether it was in the islands of Indonesia or whatever it might have been, was this utter lack of regard for human life as we hold it now.
An utter lack of regard for inclusivity, which is basically the core message of your book.
Absolutely. And but I mean, I think the thing is that's exactly the core of the book, so I have nothing to disagree with. But but I would say, you know, it wasn't just because of ignorance. Of course ignorance played a role. Of course it made it easier that, you know, the Islamic slave traders, which had been operating on the east of Africa for, you know, hundreds of years, could, you know, paint the Africans, black Africans, as inferior, or the white slave traders could paint the Africans of all sorts as inferior. That really helped. But today, you know, we live in a much more globalized, connected world. All of these human rights are everywhere, but still ethnic conflict is there, and different ethnicities are treating each other in terrible manner unless that is mediated under the right set of institutions. So, you know, I mean, I think Bosnia-Herzegovina sort of all the war in Bosnia, the Serb-Croat fighting. I mean, I think those were happening just 20 years ago.
Well, look at Rwanda, the Rwanda
and
as well.
And Rwanda, of course, even more costly in terms of almost 1 million people being killed in that genocide. Mm. But I think what we have to deal with is the incentives that people have. Unless those incentives are made more positive, unless they are mediated under the right sort of institutions, so that it's not free for all. It's not the sort of thing that's going to be rewarding people for acting in this pernicious manner. We're going to see a lot of repeat of that. And so that's why, you know, we've tried to put the emphasis on economic and political incentives, but emphasize even more that these economic and political incentives are underpinned, undergirded by the economic and the political institutions that societies have created and are still able to create going into the future.
There was this moment at the fall of the Soviet Union when it really seemed clear that capitalism had won, democracy had won. You know, Francis Fukuyama writes, "The end of history and the last man."
Yeah, that did not turn out to be a great prediction, right?
but I mean, the thing is that, I mean, you know, essentially the core of your book is saying, yes, the best system is one which really includes people politically and economically. And I think the interesting thing is that increasingly we're seeing a lot of sort of what has been called state-based capitalism, where you have countries like Russia and China, which allow a degree of economic freedom to create wealth, but ultimately have very, very little political inclusivity. I mean, the sort of the more benevolent version of that is Singapore. What do you think about countries like that? Do you think that it is possible to have these sort of technocrat philosopher kings who run a country, or does it have to be democracy?
Well, let me, I'll come back to that one second, but let me actually say something because you brought a very, very important point. I think what the fall of the Soviet Union, you know, illustrated is not the inevitability of or inexorable rise of democracy or market-based systems, which is what Fukuyama interpreted it as, but it illustrates very well why certain alternatives are themselves not sustainable. And that if you actually allow people, they're going to try to construct these more inclusive political and economic institutions, but there is not an easy path to their construction. And what we have seen, in fact, following the fall of the Soviet Union is that although there have been a number of very notable success cases like, you know, the Czech Republic, Slovak Republic, the Baltic states, and so on, Poland, certainly, but there have been so many other cases in which, after the fall of the Communist Party, some other elites, often those that had cut their teeth from in the Communist Party, have taken control and have set up as extractive, as kleptocratic, as damaging a system. You see that in Azerbaijan, you see that in Uzbekistan, in Turkmenistan, in Armenia, in Russia itself, in Ukraine, in Ukraine. And that is, I think, the other important lesson, that building institutions is really difficult.
Well, also, one of the things that people always talk about, the rise of China. And what I notice is that China may be very good at producing things, but they certainly aren't in the area code of the United States in innovation.
And your chapter on China was amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, it was really excellent.
Thank you. Now, that's exactly. And that's what I think brings me to the other point that, you know, you raised, which is very important, state capitalism. So I think, you know, China and Singapore definitely show that you have a viable set of economic and political institutions that are very different from the inclusive ones, the ideal inclusive ones that we paint, that are still able to get some amount of growth. But that is exactly what we call in the book extractive growth, meaning growth under extractive institutions. And what we try to emphasize is that that's going to be feasible under certain circumstances, and it can go on for some time. It can generate some countries that are quite wealthy. After all, you know, one of the quintessential examples of extractive institutions that will come to anybody's mind, and we use extensively in the book, is the plantation economies of the Caribbean. Well, those were some of the richest countries in the world in the 17th century, 18th century, you know, Barbados, Cuba, Haiti, But they didn't last, of course. They could not generate economic growth. They could not generate innovation. They were rich just because they had some natural resources, the ability to grow sugar, which was very valuable at the time, that made them very rich. And to do that type of plantation, you didn't really need a participatory democracy. Of course, the particular method that they chose, very, very harsh conditions of chattel slavery, were pretty inefficient. You know, they led to huge death rates and, of course, a lot of instability because the 70, 60, 70, 80% of the population that were slaves, of course, were not happy with it. They tried to rise up against that, and it was a highly militarized society. But the important thing is that it was not a system that could last. And I think that is the right way, in my mind, to think about China also. China is not a plantation economy. It has actually mildly inclusive, mildly extractive economic institutions, but it is a system that is supported by very extractive political institutions. And I think the cost of that is not in static economic efficiency, meaning that they can import technology, they can, you know, get huge amount of investment into this sector or that sector and become a player in the world economy exporting things, but are they going to be able to innovate, create the next niche products, create the new process technologies, create the next generation of general purpose technologies that are going to change the business world? And I think that's going to be very hard, because for that you do need freedom. For that you need what we call, after just borrowing the term from Joseph Schumpeter, creative destruction, new technologies coming and destroying the monopoly of old ones, new firms coming and challenging old ones, new people coming and challenging established elites. And that's not going to be easy in China.
I love that idea of how you define innovation, the destruction of the old. And
yeah, would you mind telling our listeners just the story about the Roman Empire emperor and the man who comes to him and says he's invented a way to produce unbreakable glass?
Yeah, so Tiberius says, you know, no way. You know, in fact, this story may or may not be true. It's told in some history books, but he even kills the man, because that sort of technology is going to destabilize the system. It's, you know, if you have unbreakable glass, what's going to happen with the glass producers? What's going to happen with all of the workers who are working in that sector? What's going to happen with all of that political instability that's going to create? And most dictators, most regimes that are built on extraction are extremely aware, extremely scared of instability. And that really colors the way that they look at all sorts of things, but it also pushes them towards blocking new technologies, new ways of doing economic business in the final analysis.
Well, you know, you've made such an amazing argument in this book for why institutions, why democracy, why property rights, why individual liberties, and why it's important for a society, a strong society, a viable society, to stay wealthy and powerful, to nurture its citizens' ingenuity and risk-taking and innovation, and how important it is to reward and protect the fruits of that kind of, you know, of their labor. And I always say that, you know, we know that, you know, monarchy and oligarchy and extractionist, governments like China's, etc., ultimately become bankrupt, ultimately are never as powerful as
I don't know that people know that.
Well,
I think you're going to hear
rise
of voices of people who are saying, I mean, there already
well,
are
that's my,
a rise
but that's
of people
my question.
Voices. Yeah.
That my question becomes, I think that your ideas in this book seem to be, certainly, they have to win the day. I mean, the good ideas ultimately, I feel, are very hard to keep under the rug. Is there any indication from you that people like Putin or some of the people in the Chinese Politburo or what have you have read your book? Have you? I don't know. Have you been contacted by any of those people?
Well, no, I haven't. And in fact, in some sense, you know, if you were Putin and if you were as ruthless as he was. You know, why would you change? You're doing something that's very good for you. You're maximizing your power. You're maximizing your income and your wealth through a huge amount of corruption. You are as powerful as any leader can be. Sure, you're not investing in the future of your country. And if you take away the whole huge income that, you know, Russia is generating from natural resources, from natural gas. It's a naked economic system.
Mm-hmm.
But why should he care? He's in it for himself. He's in it for his cronies around him. And that probably does color his worldview, too. It's not that he would say, you know, he goes to bed probably every night saying, well, I am a ruthless dictator and I am looking after myself at the expense of, you know, 50 million people, 100 million people, whatever. But he probably doesn't say that. But there is also no reason for him to change his course. I think what, you know, my experience is, you know, I did go and talk to the high, very high levels of the Chinese Communist Party. And you know, it was a very, very, very disappointing experience.
Oh, no. Mm-hmm.
They
really?
Had no interest whatsoever in thinking through the shortcomings of their system, because their system was them. They are the system.
Yeah.
But what was, you know, really uplifting is if you went to talk to the third tier, the people who are not, never going to make it to the Politburo, they're never going to make it to any standing committee, people who are, you know, high-level bureaucrats, you know, just the equivalent of, you know, high-level analysts in the State Department or something like that, they really understood the shortage of the difficulties, the blockages, the bottlenecks of the system. They had actually read, many of them had read Why Nations Fail,
wow.
And they were thinking in terms of the language of the framework that we were trying to develop. And that was really heartlifting. That was really made me more optimistic at some level about China, even though, on the other hand, sort of, you know, you see what the current leadership in China is trying to do. They talk of reform. They talk of bringing down corruption. They talk of, you know, a better economic future. But it's all within the context of keeping the monopoly of the Chinese Communist Party, keeping the Chinese Communist Parties and their own control over the economy. And that's just not going to work.
Yeah, it's human. I guess it's human.
Well, but
you
it's also
keep power.
Yeah, and it's the choice that you lay out. I mean, the difference between being Barack Obama, where you make, you know, $250,000 a year, and everybody criticizes
and
you,
Hosni Mubarak,
and Hosni Mubarak, who's
exactly.
a billionaire,
$27 billion.
Yeah, you want to be that. I mean, that's exactly. I think that's a great thing. I mean, if you are a leader in one of these extractive societies, I mean, every bone in your body is telling you, just stay away from the American system. You're going to have less respect, less power, more criticism, less money.
But
less
the irony,
security.
But Professor, the irony is that they're wrong.
No,
the
but
irony
they're...
is that in fact they become less powerful in many ways.
Well, you know, it's posterity versus the present. I mean, I think perhaps yeah. in posterity, you know, somebody who really took very courageous decisions and destroyed the system on which they were riding might go down in history books. But in their lifetimes, and even sometimes in history, you know, those who just exploit every grain of power that they have, you know, are not doing that badly at all. And, you know, the other thing that, you know, in response to your question, Brian, is we are going through a really tumultuous time right now. This is the worst time at some level for people to realize that an open, flexible, inclusive system with all of its imperfections is still superior to a top-down system, to state capitalism, to growth under extractive institutions. That's a very difficult thing to see when you see the United States still trying to recover from the aftermath of the financial crisis or getting its house in order on fiscal issues. When you see Europe still reeling from the debt crisis, from lack of demand, from the financial situation that has become much worse than that in the United States. And on the other hand, you see the Chinese economy, okay, they're seeing their exports go down. They immediately opened the valves and the economy has a huge boom. Why? Because the Communist Party tells the banks, and there are a few major banks, lend as much as you can. The banks then turn to state-owned corporations and they say, we're going to lend you and take this money and invest whatever you want. And then during that time, you see this Chinese economy not fall as much as, you know, Greece or Portugal and not have the sort of crisis that Ireland has. But, you know, what you're creating is you're creating a huge amount of inefficiencies in the economy, and you're really going down this path of state-controlled economy that's not going to be very good at generating innovation at all.
Yeah.
Coming from an education background, I mean, when I read, you know, I mean, the core ideas in the book are, as I took it, I mean, there's creative destruction, there's all these other things, but the really core ideas are political and economic inclusivity. Mm-hmm. And to me, that really seemed to be two manifestations of a much more core idea, which is intellectual inclusivity. The idea mm-hmm. that, you know, all ideas are allowed to come to the table and compete on their own merits rather than on whoever it was that said them.
Absolutely. I think that's very, very important. And you're absolutely right, and we should have put more emphasis on that. But I think part of the reason perhaps we did not put as much emphasis on that, although it might have been a mistake not to have done so, is that I think sometimes debates or arguments about intellectual inclusivity can overlook the fact that it's very important to have that intellectual inclusivity together with a broader sort of inclusivity. It's not okay if there is a 10% educated elite in a society and they freely discuss every idea, but mm-hmm. the rest of the 90% is left relinquishing. They don't have access to education. They don't have access to opportunities. They are discriminated against. They become second-class citizens. That's not okay. So that's why intellectual inclusivity has to be part of a greater inclusivity.
Isn't technology, though, the internet, aren't you optimistic that the internet and how it's connecting people and getting ideas out there isn't
well, you know, I am optimistic, but you know, to tell you the truth, internet isn't it for me. Mm-hmm. Look, you know, we have the internet penetrating as much into Iran and China and, you know, and into Egypt. And you see what's going on? You know, none of these societies are having an easy time building pluralism, building inclusivity. Why not? Because I think at the end of the day they're still run by institutions and elites and driven by cleavages in society that are not easy to bridge. And until, you know, for example, in Egypt, people start recognizing each other's rights to have rights, each other's right to have political say, political voice, this is not going to be easy. Internet is not by itself going to transform that. Internet, you can use it for state control. Internet, you can use that for hate speech. Internet has been very important in the polarization of society or in some parts of the world. But I think the reason why I'm optimistic is because there is a general awakening around the world. Mm. You know, 100 years ago, you could have a society like Egypt under Mubarak or like North Korea, but people wouldn't really have the ability to realize what injustices, what unfairness this system was creating. And today, these ideas that, you know, you cannot just rule a society like an autocrat for your own benefit and for the benefit of the people around you. And that's not acceptable. And people can organize and can try to start opposition and try to change the regime. I think those ideas are so widely understood around the world that it is harder and harder for the next dictator, for the next communist party, for the next autocrat to be able to maintain his system for very, very, very long. It doesn't mean that we're going to get there very soon. It doesn't mean that there are not going to be people like al-Sisi in Egypt who are going to sort of use the opportunity and grab power viciously. It doesn't mean that there are not going to be people like Morsi in Egypt who come to power in the name of inclusivity and try to run Egypt with their constitutions and their legislation in a way that goes exactly against that inclusion. And these two groups are going to feed off each other as usual. But ultimately, it's not going to be easy for any system that is hugely extractive to become stable, protected, and totally immune from the opposition and the pressures.
People get very excited about things like the internet and technology and that it's going to solve our problems. But I think what is always overlooked is the psychological factors. You know, yes, people have the internet, but as you're talking about, you know, Republicans go on Republican websites, Democrats go on Democratic websites to reinforce their own views. And just because these ideas are able to move, I mean, my parents lived in Libya before and after the Arab Spring. And, you know, the sort of institutions that you're talking about these are not the things that people are using the internet to understand.
Right.
They're not reading Why Nations Fail in translation. I mean, they don't. I mean, you know, having talked...
Until this podcast.
Which is actually...
That's going to change it all.
Yeah. You're damn right it is.
Brian is
We're huge in Libya and Egypt.
And Brian actually has two mics right now, and he's simultaneously commenting in Arabic and English.
Arabic.
Yeah.
In Arabic.
Well, the Arabic translation's going to be out very soon.
Oh really? That's
good.
Great.
Yeah.
And they've gotten over their printing press issue.
But I mean, you know, that's the thing. These ideas don't necessarily move. I mean, one of, for me, the clearest example of that is the UN published the Arab Human Development Report, the second one, and they basically said that since the year 1000, the same number of books had been translated into Arabic as had been translated into Spanish in a single year. There is just not the same access to ideas, and I think... You know, especially the sort of the building blocks. I mean, on the most basic level, the idea of questioning or dissent is something that was stripped out of Arab culture 1,000 years ago.
You know, there was a guy who had traveled all through Afghanistan and everywhere. Notice how I say Afghanistan. That's the Pashtun way of pronouncing it. But he traveled all over.
Brian spent some time with the Pashtun.
Yeah, yeah. But he traveled everywhere. And he said, you know, you can say what you will about democracy. He said, I never, ever met any group of people, no matter where they were, no matter how remote they were, who didn't want some say in who governed them.
Of course.
Exactly.
You say that, you know, basically in Egypt, the people in Tahrir Square, or whatever it's called,
Tahrir Square.
Tahrir, yeah.
They are the ones who have the right idea. They're very aware that they know that they live under an elitist government, an extractionist government, and they know what they really need. People know what it is that they want. And
I think that is my belief, and I think the really sad part of it is that you see that really promising start, you see all of that hope, mm-hmm. and I think that hope was coming from the right place, but then it becomes so misspent, it gets stuck in such bad bottlenecks, as we've seen in Egypt, as we're seeing in Syria, and I think that's really discouraging, but I think... You know, we also have to see this as part of, you know, it's this huge amount of human suffering you're seeing in the Middle East right now, and I think nobody should belittle that in any way. But I think you also have to see that as part of the process, that it's not going to be easy to go from, you know, centuries of extractive rule, no room for civil society, no room for dissent, no room for opposition, no room for pluralism of any sort within any organization, let alone the government and the state. And from there, it's going to be a long way to building these sorts of inclusive institutions. But I think we'll get there.
It's one thing to know what you want. People may want democracy, but it's a very different thing to understand the roadmap and how you build that. And I think one of the most damaging ideas that exists in the United States is that we have this very naive fantasy that we went straight from a monarchy to a democracy. And one of the things that the chapter I think I probably most appreciated in the book was the chapter on the Glorious Revolution.
Yeah, that was great. We owe much to that. We owe much to the British and that whole struggle between Parliament and the king.
Yeah. Would you mind just talking about, like, why is the Glorious Revolution so important, and why is it so important that Americans understand that when they think about foreign policy? And why, you know, if you're in a country like Libya or Syria and you're trying to build your country, understanding the Glorious Revolution is so important as that middle step?
Well, I mean, I think, I don't want to sort of repeat the history too much, but I would say Glorious Revolution is really important for several reasons, but the most important ones are that it is the first time that you see the sort of the divine rights of kings, all of the trappings of, you know, power that came from the top being challenged, and being challenged successfully, and leading to a process of institutions building. And in that sense, we do interpret the Glorious Revolution as the beginning of British democracy, of the British Industrial Revolution, the building of a meritocratic state, education policies, all of these things, you know, indirectly, but they do indirectly emanate from the Glorious Revolution. And what's distinctive about the Glorious Revolution? So I've been thinking a lot about that, and I think the answer that we gave in the book is actually we should have been a little bit more detailed about it perhaps, but the answer we gave in the book is actually largely correct. What is really distinctive about the Glorious Revolution, which the Egyptians could not replicate, is that the opposition was formulated as a broad coalition and maintained that broad coalition by building institutions. And the reason why I was originally very optimistic about Egypt is that I saw the Tahrir Square as a broad coalition. People from very different walks of life, very different ideologies, they were all opposed to Mubarak's regimes, his kleptocracy, his cronyism, his grab of power, and they came there with the hope of building a new regime. And that evaporated soon thereafter. Instead of a broad coalition, it was replaced by several narrow interests. And these interests did not really have the objective of building institutions that are going to create pluralism, power sharing, the basis of a future Egypt, but they were trying to solidify their own reign. And for that reason, you know, when the Muslim Brotherhood came to power, even though before they came to power, they made all of the right sort of noises about being a broad umbrella and so on. As soon as they came to power, they sidelined everybody else. They tried to write a constitution that was just exactly what they wanted, at the expense of the Coptic Christians, at the expense of the liberals, at the expense of the urban groups that weren't allied with them. And that sort of started the spiral. Mm-hmm. I think that broad coalition standing up against extractive regimes and being the basis of the future inclusive political and economic institutions, I think, is the message that I would emphasize most in this current juncture.
Wow. Yeah, well, I wish everybody would read the book. I really do. These are ideas. How do you get the biggest question, and Hunter and I talk all about this. This is the reason we do the podcast, is how do you get these big ideas, these important ideas, to permeate? How do you get people to really...
I think it's just luck. I think sometimes bad ideas permeate, sometimes good ideas don't. But, you know, we've been lucky. I think we've had a number of people such as yourselves, you know, help us get the message across to a broader audience, and we're really thankful.
I do wonder though
if it is just luck. I mean, you know, there's a lot of work. I mean, you know, Everett Rogers has his book Diffusion of Innovations.
Mm-hmm. Great.
And I do wonder. I think that's the thing, is that, you know, we've come out of the era of moral relativism where, you know, we've sort of been very hesitant or reluctant to say this is the way the world works. But I think that, and, you know, the areas where we have been willing to do it, so, for example, with some public health things, we've had a tremendous success. And I think that it's, you know, there's enough history, there's enough science, there's enough research that we can start to prescribe certain broad solutions, whether
it be... No, absolutely. But I think for the broader impact of it, as opposed to, say, academic impact, really this process of... Sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy is very important. You know, like this is what Malcolm Gladwell describes in his Tipping Point. You know, you just need, you know, the ideas suddenly to get enough traction, and some ideas get a little bit of traction, some ideas get a medium amount of traction. I think there's a lot of luck.
I was going to say that. I mean, look at slavery. Slavery was just the order of the day. It was a worldwide phenomenon. Everybody enslaved everybody. Europeans enslaved each other until the African slave trade took its place. And the worldwide abolitionist movement was a pipe dream, a fantasy. There was no way you were going to stop the Atlantic slave trade. Are you kidding me? With all those millions, all that money at stake? And it did, and they did.
It takes a long time. I mean, you know, the diffusion of innovations begins with the story of scurvy, which, even though it's a very simple innovation, took something like 200 years to be implemented.
It takes a long time.
But, or it doesn't, because look at what a disaster, you know, evolution. I mean, we've had a lot of evolutionary scientists on here, and, you know, I mean, in the last 150 years, they've done a terrible job of diffusing that idea. I mean, the United States, they've
scientists are not very good
they're
not good at speaking to people.
In the last 150 years, you know, they've achieved a 50% success rate with overwhelming evidence on their side. That's a
depressing number.
Yeah. But on the other hand, I mean, if you look at what the gay marriage movement has done in just a decade, it's incredible. And I think it's very simple. They pulled at our heartstrings.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's the real key is that, you know, we've tried to diffuse these ideas very rationally. And I think what we have to do, and if you look at, you know, what Brian's talking about with his his Pashtun friends that he rides horses with and shoots Kalashnikovs.
That's classified information.
Right, but what he's...
Damn it, Hunter!
What he's talking about is that, you know, that idea has been taken from something very cerebral and made something very emotional. It's very moral. It's about every man having a say. And at that level, it's very, very easy to diffuse those ideas. And I think that's the thing is that, you know, academics, I think, are often reluctant to transform those ideas into emotional forces. But that's whether it's academics or whether it's a new cadre of people, but that's how you get those ideas to move.
I think that's absolutely right. But I think it is also more complicated because, you know, when you've had, you know, again, let me pick my example from Egypt. When you have had, you know, 100 years of extraction and people being suppressed and repressed and being treated as second-class citizens, then what happens is that each person thinks that everybody is out to get them. And mm-hmm. the reason why I think the Muslim Brotherhood behaved in the way that they did is because they thought themselves as the victim. They didn't want to go into an alliance with the other groups because they thought the other groups would ultimately sideline them and they would again become the sort of the second-class citizens, the yeah. underprivileged. And
that was their history.
We have the power yeah. now. We use it. And yeah. exactly the same thing with the other groups. The other groups, immediately when they saw Muslim Brotherhood do this, they said, look, this is exactly what we thought about Muslim Brotherhood. They're out in it to get us, and once they have that power, they're going to use that power to suppress us forever from now on. And that sort of led to exactly the spiral that brought back the military, now even more empowered, now even more vicious.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Yeah, that's the problem. Is it? You said it. You said it's one elite taking power from the other elite. In this case, it could be just one group taking power from the other. I mean, if you don't take power, the problem with the Middle East, my God, if you're a Sunni or if you're a Shia, you better figure out a way to surround yourself with big walls and big guns, because your history has been one where you're constantly at war. I mean,
exactly. And the thing is that, you know, the same doesn't happen in the UK. Or why not? Because, you know, when Labour comes to power, the Conservatives know that the institutions are there, so that, you know, the Labour leaders, both because of the inside party controls and judicial process and the parliament and all of the laws and the social norms that exist in that society, they're not going to be able to exclude them forever from power. It's part of the democratic process that there's going to be alterations of power, and under every different government, the basic rights, economic, social, and political, of every citizen will continue to be protected. But when the Shiites come to power in Iraq, the Sunnis immediately think, no, this is the end for us, because the institutions to protect them aren't there.
Well, that's what I think the United States is always, you know, the debates are never really about whether the Constitution is a good thing. It's always how you interpret the Constitution.
Right.
You know, so the Constitution is the pillar by which it's what we moor into. It's what we chain,
well, I
we
think
tether
what the Constitution
to.
Does is really, it's not the details. It's the fact that it has become respected and has some good, very important, very good parts, and those good parts, because we all respect the Constitution, because it's here to stay, it is a guarantor that things are going to happen in an orderly way under the institutional
well,
legs.
But
and
it's also it solved the political problem, didn't it? I mean, that's the big political problem we're talking about, the Constitution, the Federalist Papers and stuff. Those ideas, that idea solved the political problem. The Greeks couldn't do it, and no one else could.
Right. I mean, I absolutely. I think you know what the U.S. has achieved is remarkable. We should all respect it. Whether it was because the Constitution is what it is, that is less clear to me. So, you know, whether if the Constitution had been different in some respects, the same sort of pact and social contract, and the same institutions, whether they could have been built or not, that's an open question to me. It certainly had certain elements of it which were sine qua non. Without the respect that the Constitution had for free speech, for the participation of the people in political life, it would not have been feasible. But there were lots of other details. You know, the Constitution did not give any rights to women or to blacks. It sort of enshrined slavery. It sort of really limited many of the powers of the federal government, you know, income tax regulation and so on and so forth. you know, some of those were political compromises. Some of them reflected the sort of the predispositions of their day. So I you know, my interpretation is not that the Constitution is a sacred text, but it is a durable text, and that's what really matters.
Well, and to a certain extent, what matters is that Americans think of it as a sacred text, right? Even if people haven't read the Constitution, I think what you're saying is they know that there is this thing called the Constitution.
Yeah, it's durable. It's going to stay here. It's not, nobody's going to tear it out, and that gives stability, predictability to the U.S. political system in a way that, you know, many other countries all over Latin America, all over the Middle East, just lack that stability.
Though the, Latin America, to a large extent, is an example of how certain good ideas can permeate and change entire societies. I mean, Latin America,
but also very slowly. I mean, I think that's exactly that. You know, if you ask me why I am at the end against all of these recent changes, why I am optimistic about, you know, what's going on in the Middle East, is because of Latin America. Latin America, these good ideas started permeating that continent together with some of the institutional, institutional prerequisites of it, starting in the at the beginning of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
You know, many of these countries reached their independence. Many of them have, you know, started universal suffrage in the beginning of the 20th century. But, you know, these were also deeply divided, very unequal politically, socially, and economically, very unequal countries. And it took a very long time and a series of coups in places such as, you know, Brazil or Argentina or Peru or Guatemala to actually reach this place that we are right
because
now.
There are
places like Venezuela where things are really still screwed up. But there is a huge amount of progress. Democracy is working in much of the continent. Governments are acting as representatives of the people, and they're dealing with fundamental economic problems.
So let me ask you this. I mean, you know, if we're talking about just to take the parameter of economic inclusivity, right? I mean, obviously there are laws where, you know, the laws are explicitly extractive or the barriers to creating a business are so great that it's very difficult. But in a country like the United States, where broadly speaking, you can create a business, don't cultural factors also make a huge difference? We had an African-American gentleman on here yesterday who became the largest crack dealer essentially in the United States in the 1980s.
Rick Ross. Yeah.
And, you know, the institutions don't necessarily work in his community, but a large part of it, he said, was the fact that he couldn't read. And that, you know, he never really thought of that world of sort of legitimate business as being for him. Do cultural factors, I mean, do you think in that sense cultural factors also make a difference?
Well, I would say, you know, what matters are formal and informal institutions, or institutions and the social norms surrounding them. You know, institutions are useless without some norms supporting them. We just went through the constitutions, the U.S. Constitution's discussion, and, you know, if tomorrow everybody woke up in the United States and decided that, you know, the Constitution didn't mean anything, nobody else was going to obey the Constitution, nobody else was going to respect it, that Constitution ceases to have any value, any authority in the United States. So in that way, you know, it's more than what's written on paper. It's the reality of what these institutions are, what they imply for incentives. And if you're thinking about, you know, inner cities, you know, if you go to a school where there are gangs, where, you know, the police is discriminating against you, and there are no job opportunities, you know, it's not just what the Constitution says, but the reality of this institution on the ground that's going to matter. So I think you really have to take that into account. The reason why we argue against culture is that then it's a small step, but a dangerous one, in my opinion, to say that this is just culture in the following sense, that these people have in their culture to act in this way, whatever these people are and whatever that way is. Mm. And if you take that as your starting point, you are astray, both from a scientific point of view of analyzing what the problem is and from the point of view of trying to bring solutions to it. Instead, it's not a culture that, you know, African Americans have or the Hispanics have or the Jews have, but it is the social norms that have developed. And we see that when you change institutions, when you change incentives, the social norms change in a way that culture would be very difficult to change. You could have said that, you know, the Chinese have a culture, the Confucius culture, that will make them very non-individualistic and very much follow the herd. But then you see, you know, the Chinese economy becoming much more open, and now the in China everybody's individualistic, everybody's after their own nuclear family and showing off their wealth and so on. So you know, when the incentives, when the environment, when the institutions change, those social norms surrounding them also do respond. But this is not to say that they don't have a major influence on our lives.
Well, and to the same extent, I mean, I think the other great example is the Armenian community. The Armenian community that was under the Soviets and the Armenian community that lived in Lebanon.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. You know, you see these different communities, and you know, again, with the China, the Chinese who are in China versus those in Hong Kong or Taiwan, you see how different they behave.
Well, and I mean, you know, it's always funny when you talk to Hong Kong Chinese about mainland Chinese. They don't even really, like, consider themselves the same.
Right, yes.
Yet they are. I mean, watch the World Cup. Everybody seems to cheer exactly the same way. You know, that's... Professor, in closing, can you talk a little bit about your personal connection to this book? What got you to write this book? And your own background?
Well, you know, I grew up in Turkey. And I grew up... when Turkey was a dictatorship, it was going through a deep economic crisis. Nothing seemed to work, and you know, it was and under the dictatorship, you know, talking about politics had become taboo. You know, people were definitely apoliticized. You know, you could worry about the economy, but you know, politics was in a different world. And you know, I just as a teenager, I started sort of wondering, but you know. You know, but could it be that these are all connected, that, you know, our economy is so screwed up because our politics is so screwed up? And that sort of is what got me into economics. And at first, you know, I started studying economics and I, you know, did the usual things that the economists do, study unemployment, you know, human capital, training. But then, you know, the deeper I started digging into the questions of technology and economic growth, the more I realized that the sort of my preoccupations as a teenager that got me into social science in the first place weren't totally irrelevant, and so I started thinking about, you know, trying to bring those things together. So that sort of was my foray into political economy and institutions as an academic discipline. And I was lucky to run into James Robinson early on, you know, who was thinking in similar ways and was similarly dissatisfied with economics when it came to its approach to economic growth and economic development. And so, you know, that started our lifelong friendship and collaboration. And ultimately, we wanted to sort of share what we learned over, you know, over 15 years or more of academic research with a broader audience.
You hear that, America? 15 years of research, and that's what you get when you get Nations Fail. That's an important thing. That's how long it takes. I got friends who are like, it took me almost 3 months to write my script. Yeah, well, it takes for... I know how long it takes to write a one-hour special in comedy, and so 15 years to come up with an idea like this. You guys should be hanging out with Bono. Because and kick
Bono should be hanging out with you.
Well, you're
frankly.
Damn right. Kick Jeffrey Sachs out of there. Get Bono and a couple other like high profile, smart people to kind of spread the message. That's what I say.
Well, thank you. I think Bono is busy right now, so
he might be a little busy, but we'll get him on the podcast. You know,
all right, let's go for it.
That's what we'll do.
If he's on the podcast, I'll come and join you again.
Exactly,
okay,
we'll pair you up. And just a small anecdote: when I was in Turkey, I was about 19 or 20, and I met Özal, the president at the time. He couldn't have been fatter, and he was. He'd been for a swim, and he was sitting in his shorts, and people were coming up and kissing his hand. And I remember thinking, there's something wrong with that. If you're subjugating yourself to the person that is supposed to be representing you,
that is exactly the problem. I mean, you know, I think people say, you know, why is it that, you know, you have these promising starts in places like Turkey and Egypt, and it sort of doesn't work out. And part of the reason is because, you know, the democracy, inclusive institutions, have to be much more widespread. If you don't have internal party democracy, if you don't have some degree of vision where civil society holds these politicians accountable rather than groveling to them, then it's not going to work. And then what you get is like people like Özal or Erdogan today, or pretty much every Turkish politician that has stayed in power for more than a few years, they start seeing themselves as God. because mm-hmm. they are so powerful. Everybody is coming and kissing their hand, and they have so much power, and they're surrounded by yes men. And then, you know, you cannot expect these people to start building inclusive institutions.
Well, I mean, that was the interesting thing. We actually had Datcher Keltner on, who's a professor at UC Berkeley, talking about basically what power does to people's brains.
Mm. And I would love to see that. I would love to hear that podcast.
You can get it on the Brian Callen show.
But yeah, he was talking about exactly what it does to people's brains and, you know, that there are real psychological changes that happen. And I think that's the thing. I also think that, you know, there's going to be we need much more interdisciplinary work because there's so much great stuff that's going on in psychology, in neuroscience, in economics, in politics. We need to bring all of that stuff together because
that
then I think
really
you
cool.
get, yeah, something really
that's
grounded.
Why we. That's why we do bring it together on the Brian Callen / Hunter Moss show. Darren Acemoglu, Professor Darren Acemoglu, Moglu. I always say Moglu because that's my nickname
that's
for
fine.
You.
That's totally fine.
That's my nickname for you?
Yes, 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 yes. You've written a great book, Why Nations Fail, The Origins of Power, Prosperity, I'm looking at the entire, and poverty. And you wrote it with James Robinson. I can't thank you enough for, and thank you, Hunter Moss, for once again finding an intellectual powerhouse. My father gets
well,
so
you.
My
thank
father
you, Brian.
Gets
thank you, Hunter. It was my pleasure to be here.
Yeah.
Oh, and we'll be sure to. I mean, listen. This is one of my top five books of all time. So you know,
thank you.
So we'll be sure to promote it as well on the website and all of that.
And I don't know if you know this, but Hunter's read pretty much everything. So you're on the academic all-star team, there, Professor. So
all right. Well, I feel very, very honored.
Well, thank you. I'm going to call my dad, and my father's going to be very jealous that I get to have these long conversations because he loves the book as well.
Oh, really? Okay, I'll be happy to talk to him, too.
you do good work, sir, and
thank you.
May your ideas prevail. We
thank
appreciate
you.
Thank
Thanks
you
very
so much,
Hunter. Thanks very much, Brian.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Brian, tell us more about what it's like to ride with the Pashtun.
Well, I'm glad you asked. I wish I could, but unfortunately, I can't.
Do you watch
the movie Zero Dark Thirty. Oh, it'll give you an idea.
Okay. Do you ever go falconing?
Sometimes I do. I have a falcon. I keep several falcons. I have that kind of wealth. I have that kind of wealth, and I wear robes.
I heard an amazing story the other day about how, you know, this is 30, 40 years ago. There's some Pakistani company and some British company, and they're competing for this contract in the Middle East. Do you know what decided it? It was that the Pakistanis arranged for all of the sheikhs to go falconing.
Ah, that's awesome.
And they were like, that's the way to go.
That is awesome. The falcon goes and catches a bird out of the sky, right?
Well, or, you know, a hare off the ground or something like that.
Damn.
Yeah, I was just in Abu Dhabi and like one of the sights is to see the falcon hospital.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The falcon hospital.
Yeah, because sometimes falcons get injured, Brian, as you know, from your extensive falconing
experience. Yes, it's just that I'm usually in the field. And I know how to dress a falcon myself.
Okay.
And by dress, I mean
so you were
cure.
You were confused by the idea that there might need to be specialists because you are a specialist at everything.
Setting a falcon's wing or its leg is second nature to a man like myself.
Yeah. I hadn't realized that.
Naturally.
So,
in fact, my falcon's name is Hunter.
Is it really?
Well, it is a hunter, after
Did you name it after me, or did I get named after your falcon?
You got named after my falcon.
Oh, that's right.
What,
okay.
Are you out of your mind?
How about that book, Brian?
Look, man, and I didn't realize it was in your top five.
Yeah, it's definitely one of my
top. But it should be in your top five, because it's in my top five. And just now, I mean, it's one of those books where you go, look, nobody has time to read everything. But this is a great place to start. I mean, if you want to learn history,
yeah,
that was a you know, if you that was my falcon. My falcon flies very, very low. But if you want to start somewhere and you want to get a real command of why we are here, how we got here, and why other countries are where they are. It's a really good book, but it's such a powerful argument.
Yeah.
And it gives you something to fight for. Institutions and the institutions that we enjoy in this country and that Britain enjoys and stuff and where they came from are very, very important to defend.
And very difficult to build.
Very difficult to build.
So, yeah. If anybody out there has figured out how to build these institutions, please let the rest of the world know.
Yeah, man. And Vladimir, read it. You know,
Vladimir.
Yeah,
do you think actually?
Well, Vlad and I tend to go falcon hunting.
Wait a minute. How funny would that be? How funny would it be if we like got a collection together and like basically got a little care package for Vladimir, Kim Jong Un, of just like the books
I
that
think
we should read.
And not only do I think we should do that, we should do. I want to do a TV show with you. I was thinking about this. I seriously want to do, and I don't know if we could ever get it pitched, but I want to pitch a half-hour show, and I don't care what network wants to do it, where you and I get people like Darren Acemoglu together with someone like Bono, and let's get a debate going on how to solve these kinds of problems, or at least let's have a discussion on what the problem is. Where is the root of the problem? These are really important things to talk about.
Yeah.
They just are. They affect all of our lives, and most people, maybe it's because I'm getting older, they just don't realize that. So, listen, man. I think
most of us don't. I mean, I think that's the problem is that, you know, human beings exist at the level of feelings, right?
Well, you brought up a really good point. Yeah. I'm glad you brought up the fact that interdisciplinary, you know, academics are not, they're not intertwined enough. I mean, when you look at what the brain, what happens to the brain under power, you know, that's an important thing to talk about, actually, for Darren and for a lot of people to understand that, you know.
Well, and I mean, you know, when you read Francis Fukuyama, who we're going to be having on the show, but when you read Fukuyama's The Origins of Political Order, you know, what he makes clear is that every single political or economic system rests on an idea about human nature. Right. You know, capitalism believes that if you provide people with the opportunity to make wealth, that they will be far more creative, that they will work harder, that they will do
that. That was always the
things.
Argument with yeah. capitalism. It's synonymous with human nature, right?
Yeah. And that's Adam Smith understood an important piece of human nature that had not been understood until then, or rather he distilled it because it wasn't entirely his work. He just brought together the work and the thoughts of a lot of people. But you know, the difference is that, you know, when in the 1700s, when Adam Smith is writing The Wealth of Nations, and when, you know, the founding fathers are putting together the Declaration of Independence, they're guessing at human nature. We actually now understand a lot about human nature from psychology, from science, from people like Jonathan Haidt, who we had on, from Datcher Keltner, from all these sorts of researchers. And we should be using those insights to, you know, understand what some of our conclusions at a deeper level and also to reach new conclusions.
I like the way you encapsulate stuff. I have to say that when I listen to your talk sometimes and you ask the questions, I go, the fucker's way smarter than me. I know you don't like that word, but I'm like, that's why he went to Harvard, not
Brian,
went to American.
It's not smarter. It's sharper.
Damn,
it's
sharper.
Like a sword. You know, you just keep sharpening the sword,
and then you're so smart.
So Ginzu, and then you can just cut through, you know, cans and things like
I'm
that.
I'm going to box after this.
Well, you know, that's
I'm a pugilist.
I'm not going to say that hitting your head against things like
I got punched in the face. I got punched in the face a lot yesterday.
Yeah, why would you do that?
Because I'm 47 and still can't live down the fact that I'm not going to be a pro fighter. Now,
well, but Brian, alternatively, learn that you can be a pro fighter in the world of ideas.
Hello.
And
with that point of view, ladies and gentlemen, this has been the Brian Callen Show.
Yeah.
Fuck Hunter Bots.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.